One thing we've noticed historically is that the first people government protects when there's a threat is government officials. They get treated a lot better when it comes to protection. Do you ever notice if somebody kills a policeman? Suddenly, every cop in 100 miles is out there with automatic weapons intent on demolishing the first suspect they run across. Right? They really come out of the woodwork when a police officer is killed or even not killed but simply attacked. But suppose I'm attacked. Well, you know, the best we can expect out of that is a lethargic investigation. All in due course, you know. We're busy, pretty busy here. He's just a no-account ordinary civilian. Right? They protect themselves a lot better. In many societies, there have been actually separate degrees of penalty for laws. If you commit a crime against a government official, the penalty is substantially greater at law than if you commit it against anybody else. Right? They take care of themselves. And the way we saw this in the bunkers recently was after 9/11, President Bush established a shadow government of 75 or more officials, I'm reading from a report on this, who live and work in mountainside bunkers outside Washington in case nuclear-armed terrorists strike the nation's capital. Now, if you happen to be living in D.C., well, duct tape is what they recommend for you. But they've got nuclear secure bunkers for themselves. They've got a system called Continuity of Operations Plan. And lately, I don't know if some of you noticed, but recently there was a new presidential directive on continuity of operation of government, which basically declares that the president will have dictatorial powers whenever he says he wants them, which is whenever he says there's a national emergency, and under this directive, he will take control of any part of the economy, the entire government, there won't be any division of powers anymore. There will just be the president deciding everything that's now decided by Congress and the judiciary. It's an astonishing directive. Look it up. I think you'll be amazed at what this provides for. And this isn't even an executive order. This is just a plan that the president's issued for his subordinates about what they're going to do as soon as he declares a national emergency, if they choose to. Under the Classified Continuity of Operations Plan, 75 to 150 senior government officials drawn from every cabinet department and some independent agencies work out of two fortified sites along the East Coast. In a worst-case scenario, the shadow government would help Cheney, I'm reading, would help Cheney manage America's affairs after a crippling strike on Washington and the presidency. And in fact, this whole plan here is basically Dick Cheney's brainchild, as are so many other things in the past 6 years. Bush aides said Cheney helped shape the project by drawing on his experience in government during the Cold War, when the United States made contingency plans for a nuclear strike from the Soviet Union. I actually toured one of those bunkers. There were many of them in the United States. I toured one in the north end of Seattle. Must have been about 15 years ago, and it was still set up to be occupied at any time. It had all the food stores and equipment and fuel for the generators, and it was a very big underground facility suitable for probably, 50 or 60 people at least to live in indefinitely and have power and food and water and communications and so forth. And it was built in such a way as to withstand a nuclear explosion over the city of Seattle. So now they really had never sent me a notice that I should go there in the event of an impending nuclear attack, and I took that as a subtle indication they really didn't want me there that it was for somebody else, not for people like me. The Pentagon also rotates top military officials to secure sites. A few hours after the terrorist attacks at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, five military helicopters settled into a hidden landing pad at a Pennsylvania mountain site, and other military personnel arrived in buses to Site R, the hollowed-out granite mountain shelter built in the early 1950s to withstand a nuclear attack. That's a huge thing, that Site R. It's like an underground hotel. It's so big. But you notice this is all for high government officials. Now basically giving you three sort of stages in the development of the stationary bandit. One was fear for your life and pay tribute. The next was fear for your soul and pay tribute. And then the third was look to the rulers for protection and pay tribute. And the final one, which brings us up into modern times, is embrace a collectivist ideology and pay tribute to the rulers. The development of nationalism in the last several centuries brought with it the idea that people have a popular duty to the state. You know, historically, the state was just a group of people that ruled you and exploited you, and maybe you believed they were divine or not, but they weren't one of you. You knew that well enough. But with the development of nationalism, and particularly with the development of democratic dogma, people came to believe that they and the state were one and the same thing. We all vote for one of us to be the ruler. The ruler's not anything special. He's just one of us. And as democracy became more and more widespread, as the franchise was spread, more people had a vote, became involved in some way in the governmental processes, a lot of organized coalitions were formed as people attempted, in a sense, to just get their snouts in the trough along with the rulers. Because now it's all democracy. We're all here slurping from the same trough under democracy. So we'll organize my interest group and you'll organize your interest group. And that's democracy in action. But you see, at the end of the day, you can only be a net gainer in this process if somebody else is a net loser. And in general, what this has been always is that certain groups didn't organize very well or at all, and others, particularly those groups with small numbers with an intense interest in a certain government policy, organized much more readily. And so the small organized groups became, as it were, part of the supporting coalition of government and looked to the government for benefits of all sorts that they could get. It wasn't always direct payments or money or something like that. It might be some kind of policy that had indirectly the result of bettering their position. Things say businessmen go to their legislators and try to insist on licensing for people in their business, for example. That's a way to cut down on competition from the unlicensed, and therefore there's less competition, and the people who are in the profession will, other things equal, earn more income from it than they would if there were more suppliers. So they gain indirectly, and there are countless ways to gain indirectly from government. And these organized coalitions are always looking for new and better ways to use the power of government to get something at the expense of the general public or their competitors or foreigners or someone else. Now, this led directly to the welfare state, which has its origins in the late 19th century. And didn't spread to this country very quickly. First began in Germany, spread to other European countries, and didn't really hit the United States in full force until the 1930s. But then it hit very hard and spread very quickly from that point onward until until now, we have countless programs, some of which I mentioned when I was going down my list, of ways in which the government is doling out help or protection of some kind to people through the political process. Now, that brings us to a point where we have pretty big involved governments, and it also brings us to a point where the intellectuals have become fully engaged. They've, as it were, taken over from the priests. It used to be the priests were the ones that were in charge of providing the rulers with legitimacy, but starting in probably the 19th century in any important way, the intellectuals began to be the sources of legitimacy for the stationary bandits. And they would provide countless theories of why the welfare state was a good idea or why big government activities of all kinds were necessary and essential for the public's well-being. And probably a lot of you have been to universities, so you know that a big part of what universities do nowadays in the social sciences and humanities is to concoct justifications for stationary banditry. They don't quite represent it that way. These are all ways of bettering mankind, of course. But you see, I learned to be suspicious of ways of bettering mankind that require the government to point a gun at innocent people and say, give me your money or I will kill you, which is what taxation always involves ultimately. We don't think of it because we just give them the money. We don't make push come to shove. But if you think it through, you'll realize that if you're adamant, if you're stubborn, if you say, no, I won't pay my taxes, and they issue you a summons, and you say, no, I won't go to court, and they come to arrest you, and you say, no, I won't be arrested, that you're getting perilously close to the point at which they either club you into submission and haul you off to jail, or they shoot you on the spot. Okay? You are not at liberty to decline these blessings. Eh? We're all supposed to pay when told to pay. All right? So the stationary bandits have all these justifications for what they do. And then every time there's a crisis, as I've been writing for 25 years, they seize on that crisis to jack up their activities to an even higher level in the guise of protecting people from the latest terrible threat that people are afraid of. And in a panic, people always think, yes, yes, we must have this. The government must help out here and protect us. And once the government takes over some new area, then it never recedes to the status quo of the pre-crisis period for all sorts of reasons, and I've written a lot about that in the past. I won't go into it now. Now, the political economy of fear has some economic attributes, just like any kind of production has. I speak about the laws of production when what we're producing here is fear. One aspect is there is diminishing marginal productivity, so that if the government says we face a certain threat and people respond, yeah, they really do become afraid of it and approve of some government measure to protect them, but it never happens. Okay? Then the next time government says, well, we face that fear, well, people are not quite so frightened that time. And you keep this up, and eventually people are not frightened at all. They say, you know, they're always telling us that we face threat X, but it never happens. This is baloney, you know. They're just trying to scare us. They're just trying to mill us into line here. Forget it. So it doesn't work. There's diminishing marginal productivity. And because of that, the government requires new crises to relieve people of their sense of serenity and to make them fearful and worried again so that government can make them again submissive to increases in government power. During the Cold War, we saw this in a very stark fashion with a series of so-called gaps. Probably many of you remember the missile gap. that was a campaign issue in the election of 1960. The Democrats and Jack Kennedy claimed that President Eisenhower had allowed a dangerous missile gap to develop between the U.S. missile forces, ICBMs, and the Soviets. So now we were at grave danger because they had more of these things or more powerful ones than we did. And that was a big campaign issue that helped Kennedy win the election. But before that, there were other gaps that weren't quite so highly publicized, but were publicized quite a bit. Right after the end of the war, there was a troop strength gap. The Red Army had these millions of men under arms, and the U.S. Army had reduced its ranks tremendously at the end of the war from 12 million down to about 1.5 million. And so the Soviets had 2 or 3 times more troops, and we faced a troop strength gap. So many people argued we needed to build up our armed forces. And then came a bomber gap. You know, the Russians were supposed to have bigger or better bombers than we did. Then the missile gap came along. And in the 60s, the anti-missile gap came along because we were told that the Soviets had ringed Moscow with an anti-missile system so that, you know, we couldn't even get at them with our bombers anymore. They would be shot down, and maybe even our incoming missiles would be shot down. That wasn't so clear. But we didn't have an anti-missile system, so we had to have one. Otherwise, we faced this terrible missile gap. And this just kept going to the end of the Cold War. There was a defense spending gap in the 1970s that the conservatives complained of with a lot of publicity. There was a thermonuclear throw weight gap, which meant that the Russians had huge missiles that could, you know, lift a warhead of a ton, and ours would only lift 3/4 of a ton. So there was a throw weight gap. And people spoke of the hollowing out of the U.S. armed forces in the 1970s. That was a big conservative issue leading up ultimately to Reagan's election in 1980. That sort of politicking contributed. All of those gaps, by the way, were spurious. Not one of them was real, with the possible exception of the thermonuclear throw weight gap. But when you think about it, that's idiotic. Who cares if the Russian missile can lift more than ours? We had 40,000 of these damn things, you know. We could have destroyed life on Earth 1,000 times over with what we had. What did we need with a bigger one? It was absolutely absurd, as indeed were almost all of these gap worries. If you think about them for long, they make no sense whatsoever. And, you know, if we have here any aficionados of the film Dr. Strangelove, you'll recognize the logic we've got going here. Posters, right? And what's so beautiful about Dr. Strangelove, which in my judgment, humble though it be, is that that was the greatest film of all time, is that Strangelove is absolute 100% truth. It looks crazy. But when you look into what was really being done in the armed forces at that time, you find it's not crazy at all. It's all too close to the literal truth of what was being planned and argued and the way it was being planned and argued. I can't even get started on that. It's too horrible. But this was nonsense stuff, but it did make some people afraid. It made them think that somehow the United States was being improperly or incompletely defended against the Russians, and that put us somehow in jeopardy of all being killed. We were, I'll hasten to add, all in real jeopardy of being killed, because when you have two sides with thousands of nuclear warheads 30 minutes away from one another and already targeted, we're in grave danger, and we were, and it's one of the luckiest things in all human history that we didn't fight a nuclear war. So if you believe in God, thank God. Now, the media come into play here again and again, and in a sense, their role is to soften up people, to make them kind of chronically afraid so that when some crisis comes along, they will be more than ready to give the government, or actually to demand that the government take measures to protect them. So it's all this, if it bleeds, it leads. If it terrorizes, it gets prioritized and what have you. So we create artificial apprehension. And in this context, we call forth a veritable army of opportunists. These are not necessarily people who have any strong ideological convictions whatsoever. They're mostly just people that want to make a buck and promote their careers and do other things that, you know, most of us are trying to do to get through life comfortably. Most recently, I mean, you're all familiar with something called the military-industrial complex, whose principal purpose is to enrich the workers and stockholders of defense firms by making a lot of useless junk that purports to be helpful to the armed forces. But most recently, we've got a new complex spring almost out of nothing, and I call it the security industrial complex. And these are contractors not supplying the Pentagon, but supplying other government departments for the purpose of supposedly protecting the homeland. In 1999, just a few years ago, there were nine contractors providing the federal government with homeland security equipment or services. Nine. When I did a brief study of this, it's almost 2 years ago now, I think, there were nearly 40,000 contracting firms providing, many of them providing the Department of Homeland Security with goods and services, others providing other government departments with Homeland Security goods and services. They make gizmos, equipment. A lot of them are massaging data or purporting to create information management systems. There must be thousands of them working on ways of keeping us all under surveillance, of collecting information about every move we make. 40,000. I'm sure by now it's more because the growth was astronomical. And think of that. We're now spending in this country close to $50 billion a year for Homeland Security goods and services. Now, if you look into this, what you find is that this industry has the things that every industry has. It has newsletters, magazines, websites, labor exchanges, you name it. You want a job in Homeland Security? Now hit the web, and you'll find places that bring employers and employees together. If you're some kind of an IT person, got it made. All kinds of engineers, got it made. Computer jock, got it made. Homeland Security. Okay? This is opportunism. These are people who see their chance, and they're taking it. And the taxpayers are paying for this. And, you know, if there were a real threat and these measures were having some real effect in meeting it, it'd be a little different. But the threat is next to nil. It's almost wholly imaginary. It's almost one of Mencken's hobgoblins. Not quite, but almost. And it's become the pretext for tremendous volume of robbery of citizens and a creation of a great deal of fear to pull this off. Outright war, of course, is the best thing of all for government. Government grows faster during wartime than any other time. Government officials exercise greater powers then than at any other time. Opportunists do better in war than at any other time. Because during war, the public is most afraid and most willing to pay high taxes and to surrender liberties. And that's been our history from the beginning of this country, but it's the history of other countries as well. John Zogby, the pollster, wrote after the September 11 attacks, "I've never seen anything like it before. The willingness to give up personal liberties is stunning because the level of fear is so high." Finally, let me tell you a little bit about how fear was used in a very calculating way by the Bush administration in the lead-up to the election of 2004. As I mentioned before, if there's a threat and nothing happens, that threat dissipates after a while and people's fears wear away. And that wasn't good for President Bush seeking re-election, because he staked everything on his role as the leader of the war on terror and the protector of the American people from terrorists. And already in 2004, Iraq was turning sour, and so he needed to hype the terrorist threat where people were still willing to swallow the idea that he was protecting them from real terrorist threats. And so they put the government on this very hard, particularly Secretary Ashcroft worked hard, and the Homeland Security Czar worked hard, and many others worked hard at this, spreading publicity about terrorist threats. And Jim Bovard wrote an interesting piece, actually published fairly recently, a couple of months ago, called "How Bogus Fears Bought Bush 4 More Years." And just a little summary here. He says, Bush was reelected in large part because he boosted the number of Americans frightened of terrorism in 2004. In October 2001, 73% of Americans feared another imminent terrorist attack. Okay? So right after the event, 73% feared an imminent terrorist attack. By early 2004, only 55% had such fears. So you see, we've had a substantial reduction already. But by August 2004, the figure had rebounded to 64%. This 9% proved vital for Bush, because people who saw terrorism as the biggest issue in the election voted for him by an almost 7-to-1 margin. Okay. So people who think terrorism is the main threat we face, they're going to vote for Bush. The more such people you can create, the more Bush voters you create. And that's how they went about doing it. There's another interesting piece written by John Judas, editor of the New Republic, in August this year. And it's a little differently put together, but considers the same issue in part. Judas started out by talking about some psychologists who had done some interesting experiments on fear. And they had found out that if you can make people afraid of their own death, particularly, then in the process you trigger some other things that go with that, some predictable outlooks in these people. To sort of summarize it, they wrote that the mere thought of one's mortality can trigger a range of emotions, including a disdain for other races, religions, and nations, preference for charismatic over pragmatic leaders, and a heightened attraction to traditional mores. They call this worldview defense. People who are afraid of being killed are more likely to exhibit these various traits of worldview defense. It's, to me, it reads a little bit like, you know, you're creating American conservatives if you can make people afraid. But I don't want to say this is only something that happens to conservatives, and that's not what they're saying either. They're saying it happens to anybody. And Bush's popularity, I'm now quoting Judas, was sustained by mortality reminders. The psychologists concluded in a paper published after the election that the government's terror warnings, the release of Osama bin Laden's video on October 29th, and the Bush campaign's reiteration of the terrorist threat, such as Cheney saying on election eve, "If you make the wrong choice, then the danger is that we'll get hit again." You know, subtle Dick Cheney. That these things were integral to Bush's victory over Kerry. And I think probably some of us can remember how hard they were working along these lines. It was their only issue, as I recall. I mean, normally people say it's the economy, stupid, but Karl Rove thought it's the terrorism, stupid. And he was right. They pulled it off just by playing the fear card once again and playing it very hard on that occasion. So I'll just conclude by a short statement that from top to bottom, the government wants us to be afraid, needs us to be afraid, invests greatly in making us afraid. Were we ever to stop being afraid of the government itself and of the bogus fears it fosters, the government would shrivel and die, and the host would disappear for tens of millions of parasites in the United States, not to speak of the vast number of others in the rest of the world who now sap the public's wealth and energies directly and indirectly by means of government power. Okay, thanks.